I gather my duty as a, what? My duty as a last speaker is to, on behalf of the all present, to thank the organizers for doing a wonderful job. Okay. The second thing I'd like to mention is not related to my talk, but just as a point of mathematical integrity, I'm flattered by Mike's comments, but as a point of integrity, I should say that the comment I made after Arthur's talk was mostly stupid because, in fact, Veach proved that almost every interval exchange is indeed rigid in the early 80s. I kind of recalled, and Arthur confirmed by showing me the theory. Okay, so now to the business. I am going to talk about partially hyperbolic systems. In that sense, it's a part of the program. Even though it's kind of different story, and I'm actually grateful to Dima Kleinbock, who mentioned partially hyperbolic algebraic actions. So at least the object of my talk has appeared in a couple of last lectures. However, the setting is completely different, because what Dima was telling us is that those guys are pretty soft in some sense. There are lots of exotic stuff sitting there. If you take a typical partially hyperbolic, say, one parameter flow, algebraic flow, there is lots of, well, I wouldn't call junk, but fluff, you know, lots of exotic orbits. So situation changes dramatically when you pass from a single, from rank one actions to higher rank actions. So the most general I used to say ZK or RK for K at least 2, but this is a more proper setting because, for example, some of the wonderful work of Alan Lindenstrauss includes a mixed situation. So this is a mix, this is a setting, and in fact, what we are doing is the first steps in which I hope will be eventually successful, but definitely ambitious program, showing that in some sense most of partially hyperbolic algebraic actions are actually rigid. Rigid means that if you make a small perturbation of the action, it's differentiably conjugate to a certain very limited list of perturbations. You'll see the examples first. Now, there are two. So here is a condition. Maybe when we give a little bit of more thinking to this subject, we'll call it conjecture. But in any case, this is a condition for an algebraic action of this sort of group, which may produce various rigidity phenomena. That's a, so to speak, minimal condition. But in many cases, it's actually sufficient. So the condition is, I'll explain, I would not read this. I will explain, you will see two specific cases where this condition appears. This is a rigidity condition. So it's not impossible that under this condition you have actually differentiable rigidity, but so far we made key but limited steps. Limited in the sense that we only consider certain classes of actions, but representative. So that's a story. Why is this so, I would say, interesting? Well, to begin with, unlike the hyperbolic situation, where you have some sort of rigidity at least at the level of C0 structure. So basically in a hyperbolic situation, what you do, you first take rank one, you know, individual elements or whatever, and then you say that because of the presence of commuting ones, this conjugacy, which is a priori only topological, happens to be smooth. That's a method which we developed with Spatzer and Gaisinski, and which was used on other occasions for other situations. Here, the situation is different, because an individual partially hyperbolic element or flow is in no way, it's very far from being structurally stable. So the orbit structure is pretty loose, even taking into account the Kirch-Kirchhoff partial hyperbolicity, which helps a little bit. It's still, so the rigidity comes completely from the existence of a non-trivial smooth condition. So that's the kind of, what's that? Uh-oh. I'm terribly sorry. Yes, it's end home page. Oh, page down. Okay. So far, we've treated two cases which are at the opposite end of the spectrum and which remarkably require different methods. So the first case is the action by commuting automorphisms of the tools, for which the condition above is equivalent to a well-known condition, existence of a subgroup isomorphic of Z2, all of whose elements except for identity are ergodic with respect to Lebesgue measure, okay? Or equivalently, there is no non-trivial rank one factor. Non-trivial mean with infinite fiber. We proved this, there was a subject of Daniela Damjanovic thesis, and this is the text which, the full text is still a preprint, but the announcement has been published in ERAMS a while ago. The full text is available. Now, in some sense, the method here, it's hard analysis, and it's subtle in some points. It uses a com-type scheme, where remarkably, the higher rank condition allows to carry out the induction. It allows to solve the approximate equation. But in this situation, for example, in order for this method to work, we need perturbation which is small with huge number of derivatives. So we don't know, for example, if for C1 or C2 perturbations. So that's one case. And the method here, Calm is a kind of shell, but the heart is essentially harmonic analysis. It's in this case, harmonic analysis is abelian, so we are able to carry tame estimates and stuff. In principle, harmonic analysis method may be applicable to other cases, but difficulties are formidable, and I don't think they are strictly technical, but anyway, I don't want to talk about that now. Okay, so here is the subject of my talk. It's a very different kind of example, which is not far from what Dima Klimbok talked about. So the basic object is a wild chamber flow on a cell in R mod gamma. Well, gamma in this case is co-compact. I can say right away that the proper modifications for, say, SLN0 or something certainly are available, but one has to really say what small perturbation means. But kind of in order not to be, not to go into that because I don't know of any specific applications, we would assume it's a co-compact. So the wild chamber flow is the action of, from the left, if we consider the right factor, contrary to what number theorists usually do, it's an action by positive diagonals, by left translations, and we can identify this group, obviously, with its Lie algebra or with this n-dimensional space. So we'll talk about lines, planes, hyperplanes, and so on in this group, meaning this space. So this action itself is an osmosis, as an action of Rn minus 1. So for this action, differentiable rigidity has been proven in this action and many other examples in my joint paper with Spatzer, which actually appeared in the 60th anniversary volume for Dmitry Chernozov. We consider the partially hyperbolic. First, we consider the restrictions. Yeah, I jump a little bit. We will consider not the action itself, but the restriction of this action. Okay. So basically, what we do, we take any higher rank subspace, any subspace which contains not even a plane, but just a lattice in a plane, not a subgroup, which contains a lattice in a two-plane in a general position. And those things, of course, are partially hyperbolic, because the whole orbit filiation of the action itself is neutral. So let me go quickly through the technicality, through the notations. So the Lyapunov exponents in this case are this linear function of Ti minus Tj, if you remember. Yeah, so those are, unfortunately, you know, I only have one slide at a time. Those are Lyapunov exponents. Lyapunov hyperplanes are the kernel of Lyapunov exponents. Regular elements are elements outside the Lyapunov hyperplanes, which, of course, divide the space into number of convex cones, which are Weyl chambers. In this case, they are classical Weyl chambers from Lie theory. But this construction, in fact, applies to hyperbolic or partially hyperbolic actions in general. And we define Weyl chambers for, say, RK actions in general. But in this case, they coincide with the classical Weyl chambers. And the coarse Lyapunov distributions and filiations in this case are minimal non-empty intersections of stable distributions for different Weyl chambers. In this case, the word coarse is superfluous because this construction gives what we call coarse Lyapunov distributions. But in this case, they are one-dimensional and they are Lyapunov distributions in the sense that they integrate the isolated spaces. Okay, so quickly, in this case, that's important for the discussion. In this case, these Lyapunov filiations are one-dimensional, and they simply correspond to exponentials of standard unipotent matrices. You take a matrix with just one non-zero element in above the, or somewhere outside of the diagonal. You exponentiate it. You get unipotent one-parameter subgroup corresponding homogeneous filiation. It's invariant under the whole Weyl chamber flow, and the contraction and expansion is determined by the corresponding Lyapunov exponent. So that's this picture will play a very important role in my presentation. This filiation commutes with the orbit filiation of Weyl chamber flow, and together they form an n-dimensional filiation. So here's the main theory. We consider what we call generic restriction. So you take a closed subgroup which contains a lattice in a plane in a general position. General position means intersects distinct Lyapunov hyperplanes along distinct lines. And then one can think of G as an image of an injective homomorphism of this group into G+. So local rigidity means that the only way to perturb the action non-trivially is to perturb this embedding, which, of course, possible, a certain finite dimensional collection of perturbations. So there are finitely many moduli. It's not rigidity in the usual sense, but it's rigidity in the sense that only standard algebraic perturbations are allowed. Of course, for ZK actions on the torus, you don't have this. You just have rigidity. Okay, so that's a theory. The closeness of perturbation, as you can see, is in C2 topology. Probably with certain amount of effort we can bring it down to C1 plus epsilon, but certainly at the moment not to C1. For the whole action, we only need C1 closeness. So there are certain reasons for that, which will become apparent and which are related to one of the main topics of this workshop, namely the kind of consequences of being patient, pure Schupp, whatever theory from partial hyperbolic actions. Yeah, a simple observation is that essentially it's enough to consider the lattice itself, because once you prove periodicity for the lattice, some simple arguments give you that it carries out the whole group. Okay. So here how the proof goes. Has two preliminary steps. The main step, which is the substance of the proof, and the final step. Okay, the preliminary steps, which I will describe with certain in certain details, in some sense, you know, we reduce the problem to Hölder perturbations in the orbit direction, to the perturbations in the orbit direction only, in the orbit direction for Weyl chamber flow, which means along the neutral filiation, which is not exactly what you think, because the perturbation we'll consider will be only Hölder as an action. So it's not exactly reduction into transverse part and the neutral part. It's something more subtle than that. And the second observation is a reduction to the problem of the realization of cycles over perturbations. So the cycle problem is a linear problem. It's easier in general than conjugacy problem, which is nonlinear. However, for the partially hyperbolic case, even if you have a perturbation along neutral direction, it's not enough to prove trivialization of cocycles. You can, however, reduce it to trivialization of cocycles over perturbations. This is in some sense close to the arguments which are used in the work of Margulis with collaborators, with Kian and Fischer, for rigidity of rigidity for actions of lattices and so on, when basically you reduce your problem to a cocycle problem using global coordinates of the group. It's a very simple observation, but crucial. Then the main step is actually it's proving rigidity of cocycles over the perturbed action. I would like to point out, we do something over the action we don't know at that moment that much about. We want to show that this action is conjugate to some standard perturbation of the original one. Of course, if once we proved it, we can handle cocycles. Well, but the trick is that we can handle cocycles beforehand. And the final step, once we established Hölder conjugacy to show that in our setting conjugacy is smooth, this is relatively standard. Okay, so let's go first through this first step. So we take a C2 small perturbation. So the regular elements, so those are notation. This is a notation for the generic restriction. Alpha naught is a notation for Weyl chamber flow itself. G indicates that we restrict to G. Alpha naught tilde is a small perturbation, action of G. And regular elements are normally hyperbolic for when I say a regular element, I say there are plenty of elements. Plenty of elements which are far away from the old walls of Weyl chambers are normally hyperbolic to the orbit filiation of the Weyl chamber flow. Your neutral direction basically remains the same. So one can use, or I can try to use here Q-Schupp stability. And what one gets? One gets a Gölder homomorphism, which takes this filiation into a neutral filiation for the new action. However, both the filiation and the homomorphism are only Hölder. So we can consider this action, which will preserve now the neutral filiation, but it will be a Hölder perturbation. And surprisingly enough, we can say something about it. And this order homomorphism can be chosen C2 and close to identity along the leaves, but transversally it's still only L. Okay, so this is a setting which is, of course, not new at all. Okay, so the next step is the following observation, which is again by itself routine. Now we have a perturbation, this Hölder perturbation, of the standard action along the neutral filiation of the Weyl-Chamber flow. So it can be given by a left multiplication, but not constant, with a certain function. And this function is a cocycle, but unfortunately it's not cocycle over the original guy, it's a cocycle over the perturbed guy. So, if in particular we know that this cocycle is cohomologous to a constant cocycle, which in this case will have to be a homomorphism, then modulo some simple arguments about injectivity and stuff, which are easy, this will produce for you conjugacy between this guy and, well, what did I say? There was a little error that it has to be not alpha not j, but alpha not j composed with what I'm saying now is pretty trivial. I mean, you have this linear kind of thing. Yeah, so it'll be alpha not j, it will be a standard perturbation of alpha not j. So I'm sorry for this little error, but it's going to be alpha not j composed with this perturbed. So an issue here that, of course, even if this is true, H is still only Hölder, but that's a huge step because you will have Hölder conjugacy. Okay. So in order to carry out the program, we need to show that every Hölder cocycle over what? Now I'm being careful. I'm not saying you can take any Hölder perturbation along the orbit. I'm saying you take Hölder perturbation which is, in fact, a result of this conjugacy. So you start from some smooth perturbation, and you take a corresponding Hölder perturbation which preserves the neutral filiation. Slight subtlety. So every Hölder cocycle over this object is Hölder cohomologous to an injective homomorphism. That's the main theorem. So I repeat again what we are doing here is we are considering not yet quite well understood thing. We perturb this guy in a neutral direction, in a Hölder way, in a certain particular way, and then we prove cocycle rigidity. Okay. Now, as it turned out, of course, there's a certain history behind that, but we first proved cocycle rigidity for Hölder cocycles for generic restrictions of Weyl-Chamber flows. This is published, and I think this result is, I think it's new, because for Hölder cocycles over the whole Weyl-Chamber flow, it's, I think, in Margulis and Kleinbock. It was announced in our paper with Spatzer, but there was an error which was corrected, and I'm not sure, I don't know whether the proof based on harmonic analysis would work. But whether it would or not, it wouldn't work for perturbations. So the important thing about our proof is a method. And the method is somehow so robust that it can be, with proper exertions, extended to perturbations. So the method is based on two ingredients. One is geometric. It's a geometry of Lyapunov filiations. And the second is algebraic. It's a description of generators and relations in SLNR. This method certainly is open to generalizations because the geometric part works in many other situations. The algebraic part just requires either better knowledge of literature or algebraic K theory, or probably a little bit of creative effort. In fact, for some states, situations, one can find proper information in the literature, but in order to push it further, one has to really do the algebra a little bit more. Okay, so here is the scheme of the proof. So first, this action, this restriction, is what we call locally held or transitive. Any two epsilon closed points can be connected by a broken path whose pieces lie in the leaves of the Hölder foliations, that are called Lipunov paths, and the length of this path is comparable to a certain power. Of course, this is essentially a bracket condition. It's a bracket. It's the fact that the brackets of Lipunov foliations generate everything, and you need just a bunch of brackets. And a simple but useful observation is that coarse Lipunov foliations for the restrictions are the same as for the whole action. It's linear algebra, but it's very useful. So you can actually, by intersecting stable and unstable stable foliations for different elements within your lattice, within your two-dimensional lattice, recover completely the whole web of unipotent foliations. This is simple but crucial step, and that generalizes, of course, to other cases. Okay, the next step is some technology which essentially has been developed in my joint paper with my then graduate student 10 years ago, Alexei Kononenko. No, he was not a graduate student already, but anyway, he had been my student. And this is something which one should consider as a parallel to the famous Lipschitz theory. So how do you solve cosaical equations for hyperbolic systems traditionally? You extend your solution along the orbits. You start from an orbit, you sum up your solution along the orbit. You get a solution on the orbit, which you can extend elsewhere if certain abstractions vanish. What are abstractions? Abstractions are values of the cosaical along the periodical. That's what we call now extension along the orbits. But you can also try to extend along stable and unstable foliations. This observation was known long ago, but in hyperbolic case somehow it's only used for regularity. In hyperbolic case, the fact that once you know there is a solution, you know how the solution looks along stable and unstable, is used in all this big literature on regularity, Delayevi, Markov, Marion, whatever. However, in the partially hyperbolic case where periodic abstractions are not available, you should you can try to do better. And what we systematically developed is Kononenko. I'm not claiming we were the first people to notice that, but we were the first to systematically write it down, is that you can use these webs of stable and unstable foliations, and if they are non-integrable, the more non-integrable, the better, by constructing the solutions. Okay? And that can be modified when instead of a single pair of stable and unstable foliations, you have this Lipunov foliation. Okay? So let me quickly remind you what's done. I mean, I confess that I copied that from our paper, so notations are not probably the most appropriate. But the idea is very simple. You can define what's called potential on any stable foliation. This potential, maybe I have light for a moment. So you have a stable foliation or its part. And you have your cocycle beta. And you know, in fact, how the solution of cohomological equation would look if you know its value at the x, how it would look along this relation. It will be given by this potential. That's an easy calculation. Moreover, this series converges if cocycle is Hölder. It's a Hölder object. So you can then say, okay, so you know how your solution looks here. Then we take some other filiation, maybe stable for another element or whatever. And then you know how it would look here, and so on. And with luck, we construct our solution everywhere, or at least in the neighborhood. With the luck, because in general, you enter abstractions. I think we can turn off the lights. Here are the abstractions. You consider what we call a cycle. A cycle, we have a bunch of filiations now. Each filiation belongs to a stable for some element, but they commute. The elements commute, so filiations are all invariant for the whole action. So for such a cycle, next point belongs to one of the filiations for the previous one. We define the periodic cycle functional as the sum of these potentials. In order for our solution to be consistent, that has to vanish. In other words, if you go from one point to another by two different paths, it has to be the same. This is, well, unfortunately, I said it's equivalent. It's equivalent assuming some kind of transitivity of relations. It's, of course, not equivalent, for example, on the torus. On the torus, you have a partial hyperbolic action. Stable, you don't recover some directions, whatever you try. But in our situation, when you have this transitivity, vanishing of periodic cycle functional null cycle is actually equivalent to Hölder cohomology to a constant cocycle. So what we really need to explain why higher rank condition guarantees vanishing of this abstraction. I must tell you that even in a hyperbolic case, you can try Lipschitz, and you wouldn't succeed. It's not at all clear why Lipschitz abstractions vanish if you do it. There are two ways, basically, to use higher rank to show vanishing of the abstractions. Either you use harmonic analysis, or you use this kind of geometry. The method with periodic orbits, at least we don't know how. A posteriori, you know that Lipschitz abstractions vanish, but you don't know how to deduce it from, even in the best case, even for commuting toral automorphisms. Okay, so here is the key step. We show vanishing of abstractions on what we call contractible Lyapunov cycle. Contractible cycle is a cycle when you go to the universal cover, to SLNR in this case, it still remains closed. That's called contractible cycle. That's a key part. So it uses two observations. First, invariance of the periodic cycle functional and the algebraic structure of SLNR. That's preview. So this is all very classical. This is all very classical. It's 60s and I think the book of Milner, which summarizes all that, has been published in 1971. But of course, we are very far from algebraic key theory, and we asked a bunch of people around who were very, very excited. Because if you really try to recover that by explicit calculations, you have a hard time. Okay, so what do you really use? You use the following information about description of generators and relations, in this case in SLNR. Well, those are just one parameter unipotent elements. This is a kind of trivial part, because of course we know that there are continuous one parameter subgroups. That's fine. There are also commutator relations. And I don't know if you are naive as we were maybe a year or so ago, we thought that that was it. It is not it. It is not true that those relations actually generate SLA now. That's the point of algebraic K-theory. In fact, there is an extra relation. It's sufficient to take just one family because when you change, I mean, you can use commutators to do it for similar. Of course, it's also true for other indices. Anyway, this is a very specific relation which corresponds to the following fact. You take commutators of, you get diagonal, you recover diagonals as certain commutators of unipotence. But diagonals commute. That's what it says. So the fact that diagonals commute don't follow just from the algebra. Okay. So as I say, I tried to do exactly that. I wrote a very long relation and tried to cancel things and until I learned that it's done differently. Okay. So what actually happens? Maybe I should say it. So what happens is the following. For each of the relations, they correspond to a certain path. Because we have homogeneous relations, so you just start from a point and you take a path. Each of those relations corresponds to a certain closed path. How do we know that periodic cycle functional vanishes? Well, the key point is that it vanishes on commutator paths. Why? Because, may I have the light? This is a key observation. So you have, say, E1, 2, E2, 3, and you have E1, 3, something like that. It's symbolic with some. Okay. Those are diagonals. All those three guys lie above. So they lie in the stable manifold of the same for certain Weyl chamber. So this corresponds to a path like this. 1, 2, 2, 3, 1, 2, 2, 3, 1, 3. It's a path like that. But this path lies completely inside the stable manifold. But periodic cycle functional is invariant. So you push it along the element of the Weyl chamber for which this element is, this path is stable. It shrinks, becomes insignificant. So in the limit, the total sum of the potentials is zero. That's a key observation. Now, how else you can produce relations? You can conjugate such thing. Well, if you conjugate, of course, it's also fine, because when you go backward and forward, things cancel out, the potentials cancel out. So if you have any product of conjugates of such things, the periodic cycle function will vanish, and as I say, naively, I thought that you can write down any closed path as such product. This is not true. Algebraically, it's not true. But what Milner observed is that basically, if you use continuity, or in fact, even measurability of this into T and S, then if you want, in other words, if you, those things are called Sternberg symbols. And you want to show that they are trivial, this product of this times inverse of that. So if you know that they depend continuously on T and S, then they are essentially trivial. That's pretty much what was Milner's observation. So the non-trivial algebra is this Matsumoto description of extra relation. And if you are not over R, or if you are don't take into account continuity, you're in trouble. But if you have continuity or measurability, then, and if you are, well, there is a trivial flip, but here, you know, we. So that's the story. That's the story. So we can, in some sense, geometrically, it means that we can, in some sense, approximate any closed path by conjugates of this. But I still cannot make purely geometric sense to what I'm saying. But it follows the vanishing of the periodic cycle. Functional vanish follows from, I think we can turn it off. Okay. Well, that's almost the end of it, because periodic cycle vanishes on non-contractible path and thus define the homomorphism from gamma to D plus, and that's of course impossible by Margulis normal subgroup theorem, because D plus is abelian. Okay, so that was still proof for restrictions of the original. Now, what's our strategy? Our strategy is to recover enough of that structure to make similar arguments possible for perturbation. That's contents of our current paper, which is not listed here. It's almost, I mean, it's almost ready to be put on the web. It probably will be ready within a week. But we have a full text, just not fully polished. Okay. So what are the steps? First, we need, of course, local transitivity of strong, stable, and unstable, because that's an extra condition you need, even if your cycles vanish, but if you cannot reach from any point to any other point, it's no use. This is essentially, you know, this, it follows from Bean and Pearson work. It's been worked out in our paper with Kononenko, with proper version. Well, then we describe the abstraction to cocycle trivialization in a similar fashion. I mean, the description which I gave was completely general. This is why it's reasonably important that the action itself is smooth, that we are really dealing with smooth curves, not with just with Schroeder. Okay, and then the real work starts. Now you want somehow, now you deal with this Hölder action, which is a perturbation of our action just along the neutral filiation. And you want to compare closed passes here and there. Well, may I have a light? What we have is a canonical projection. Because, again, by Hirsch-Pugh-Shoup, we know that these filiations, which are intersections of stables of various, of weak stables of various elements, they persist. So these n-dimensional filiations, which are called UIJS, they persist. And what do I have? This filiation has one-dimensional transversal direction and n minus one-dimensional neutral direction. I know that for my new action, this is invariant. So, in fact, if I have a point, if I take the image of the strong stable, or corresponding Lyapunov, under the conjugacy, it is a funny Hölder curve. But there is a canonical correspondence along the neutrals between this funny Hölder curve and the standard psi. So, if I have now a closed path here, I can take the system closed path of this funny Hölder curves, not closed, and I have to prove, and that's the heart of the proof, that if we have a closed path here, the corresponding guy is closed, and vice versa. That's a central element. Once it's done, we are essentially in the setting of Milner. Well, I think I'm close to the end of my time. I hope I've done. Can you? I hope I've done this job explaining the structure. Of course, we need to work to show that. We need to work to show that, in fact, this both ways that the image of the closed, what we call U path, is a closed F path. I think the key part is we take a closed, funny closed path. We have a regular closed path, the nice one. And then we take its image, and then we show that its image is closed. That's a key part. After that, we can do it the other way around, because after that, if it's not the case, so this is this is kind of basically the main story. We have to show that we have to imitate not Milner, we have to use not Milner's result but Milner's argument. We have to take this extra passes which appear from Matsumoto relations, so to speak, and show that they the cycle trivializes. After that, it's relatively easy work, because once we show that every closed path for the good unperturbed system remains closed, we have to show that nothing can open, that it cannot be that an open path will become closed, that an open path will become closed. But if it's true, then for every initial point, we have a certain subset in the Gaup D plus for which passes would open. And the simple argument shows that this subset is in fact invariant under Lyapunov relations, and because of that we can show it's a subgroup, and we can show it's a closed subgroup, and then we essentially use the same argument as before with Margulis, that showing that because it's a small perturbation, we cannot have non-trivial homomorphisms. Well, this is a very rough sketch of the proof, but let me repeat. We show that the structure of Lyapunov filiations is robust enough so that this closeness condition persists both ways. So the algebra is essentially the same algebra as before. This is why I'm saying that once we understand enough algebra for other groups, this will work. This part is certainly not specific. Okay. What is next? Okay. Well, let me quickly say about smoothness. So once we have triviality or cohomology of Hölder cocycle with a constant cocycle, we use it to create Hölder conjugacy. Now we need to show that this Hölder conjugacy for the initial system is smooth. That basically uses two observations. Smoothness along, so now what we have? Now we have two smooth actions. Forget about this Hölder ugly guy, because we only use this Hölder as a tool. Now we have two smooth actions, and there is a Hölder conjugacy between them. First, we know that this, we can prove that this Hölder conjugacy is smooth along the unipotence. This is not trivial, but that's the same technology which is used in the hyperbolic case in our work with Spatzer and Gaisinski. Basically, the idea is the following. Let me remind you, because this is, of course, the old stuff, but not everyone in this room is an expert. By now we know that strong stable go into strong stable because of the Hölder conjugacy, but even if we didn't know that, it would be okay to do projection, but now we know. So we have a strong stable for the unperturbed and for the perturbed. And we know that there is a Hölder conjugacy. We know that there is an invariant affine structure here and here. Well, here the invariant affine structure is just coming from the group. Here it comes from a general principle that this filiation is actually contracting. So there is an invariant affine parameter. For one-dimensional case, it's affine. In higher dimension, it's a little bit trickier sometimes. But it's an invariant affine parameter, uniquely defined and smooth. And of course, in general, Hölder conjugacy doesn't match those parameters. Everyone who worked in hyperbolic dynamics knows that. If you take a linear automorphism over toes, a small perturbation, you do have affine parameters here and there, but they don't match. Why do they match here? Well, they match here by the following interesting reason. If you look at the picture of Weyl chambers, and if you go along the wall of the Weyl chamber, when you go, this is a picture in time. When you go along the wall of the Weyl chamber, these foliations, here we have an isometry, and because of the Hölder conjugacy, here we have an equicontinuous family of conjugacy. When we go in this direction, we know that Lyapunov exponent is zero even. But that's not sufficient by itself, because zero Lyapunov exponent for the perturbed only means sub-exponential growth. But because of the Hölder conjugacy, we know that the piece of length 1 becomes piece of length no more than whatever. So it's an equicontinuous family of maps. And it intertwines this affine maps. Well, because of course you also need to know that but since we have a conjugacy, we know that it's topologically transitive. So because of that, you basically, I mean, using the argument which is, I would say, central in higher rank rigidity and even more important in the measure rigidity than in differentiable rigidity. It's the argument saying that we have a certain structure here, we move around and we carry our own the structure, and in this case the affine structure is really, really nice and continuous. In the case of measure rigidity, you play games with losing. But whatever it is here, so this affine structure conjugacy intertwines affine structures here with affine structures there. Because of that, it's smooth. If you have two transitive, more generally, two transitive groups and they are intertwined by a map, the map is smooth. So this is not yet the end, because of course we also have remaining directions. But remaining directions are the brackets of those directions. So now, of course, you assume everything is C infinity or C100, because this argument, of course, requires lots of smoothness. But basically now you use the following general principle, which, I don't know, should be attributed to Hermander or to some of his epigons, but in any way, the general principle is that if you have a function which is smooth along the bunch of directions whose brackets generate everything, then it's smooth everywhere. And in this case, of course, the brackets of those generate everything. That's important. It's not connection, no. It's just. Okay. So this is this remaining step, which is not new. I mean, this is using technology which has been around. Okay. So that's pretty much it. Let me say a couple of words. I think I'm still more or less within my time limit. Yeah, I can probably use a few extra minutes. So, what's the story? Obviously, you want to push this to other situations. The most straightforward thing, of course, is to look at Weyl chamber flows and their restrictions for other groups. The case which is geometrically not different, only different algebraically, is if you consider something like split, other split groups. This is a split group of type A, but there are split groups of types B, C, and G. This Daniela Damianovich more or less has done. It's not written, but I mean, not written in details, but she's done necessary algebraic calculations to. So one can say that we have a theorem for the split. For the split groups. Now, if you go even in a semi-simple case, I mean, now we are kind of a little bit in a story which is somewhat similar to the story of Ratner theorem, when the certain key cases are easier, I mean, they're technically easier than others. So, even within the semi-simple setting, there are difficulties of both algebraic and geometric nature. To understand the geometric complication, think, for example, of the case when you have a compact group extension of your action. Then you have an extra neutral direction, but it's not anymore abelian. Fortunately, this technology extends to cocycles, certainly with values on amenable groups and cocycles which are not very big, even with values in general groups. So this aspect, this cocycle vanishing and so on, should work for, not, I mean, this part works for a variety of cases. If you consider something like a, say, non-split group, non-split form of a complex group, G, then the maximal abelian group in it has a compact part and the Cartan part. So the Weyl chamber flow comes when you factor out the compact part. But you can consider, of course, the action of the Cartan part on the whole thing G mod gamma. So then you simultaneously have all this stuff, and you're right away in the situation of the group extension. So in this case, you have to understand the algebra. Once you understood the algebra, I think it's everything else is. So it will be fair to say that in order to treat the semi-simple case in full generality, what we need is a proper understanding of algebra. Well, there are also exceptional groups, of course. I mean, I think the experts as a community are kind of remarkably evasive, but nevertheless, we got enough information. There are, of course, other cases. For example, the total case in principle cannot be treated like that. It has to be treated by some kind of harmonic analysis method. The most natural next case which comes close to Torus is actions on nil manifolds, and Daniela is working on that. There, harmonic analysis is probably doable using, you know, representation theory of nilpotent groups, which is much less formidable than the general case. But there are also various mixed cases, for example, so-called twisted Weyl chamber flow. So one has to put these tools together. But I think my feeling is that we have a toolkit which with enough persistent perseverance and sophistication can give eventually something close to the comprehensive rigidity theory. Thank you very much.